compete in the new global economy through entrepreneurial programs, services, and resources. More information on the Academy can be found at www.ael.uiuc.edu.
Thanks to our listeners' generosity, during our May campaign, we have moved closer to reaching our program support goal for the next fiscal year. Now, we need to finish the job. It's not too late for you to help. If you miss the membership drive, please take a moment to mail a contribution to 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. And thank you.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This morning, we're bringing you programs from the Focus 580 archive. So do remember, as you listen, we'll not be taking your calls. Today in America, maybe the worst thing, one of the worst things, certainly, that you can say about another person is that he or she is a loser. We love winners in this country. We celebrate them. And the same way, we disrespect and put down people when we say that they are losers. And it seems that if you look at American history and look back, in the past at least, this label of loser or failure didn't quite have the potency that it does today. If, for example, you look back at the early 1800s, someone who is said to be a failure is generally thought of as someone who had not been successful in business. They had started a business and it had collapsed. However, something interesting happens over the course of roughly 100 years between the beginning of the 1800s and the end of the 1800s. If you look at around the time of the turn of the last century, suddenly the nature of failure has changed. And we go from talking about someone who has had lack of success in business to someone who is, in a sense, a personal failure. That is, not so much that the business failed, but that they failed, and that the problem was really not so much with the business, but the problem was with them. We will talk a little bit about how it is this notion of success and failure developed in American history this morning as we talk with historian Scott Sandage. And he's authored a book on this subject, which has come out recently. It's titled Born Losers, A History of Failure in America, and it is published by the Harvard University Press. Scott Sandage is associate professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University. He specializes in the history of 19th century America. He's been a consultant to the Smithsonian Institution, to the National Archives, the National Park Service. Back in 99 and 2000, he chaired a panel of historians to choose an inscription for the wheelchair sculpture that was belatedly added to the Franklin Roosevelt Memorial. He's also contributed commentaries to a number of publications, including the New York Times and the Washington Post. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Sandage, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. As I say, certainly in America today, we love winners and we celebrate them. Why write about losers?
Well, about 10 years ago, I came across a scrap. Historians call it a fragment, but it's really just a scrap of paper with some writing on it by Abraham Lincoln from your stomping grounds. And he wrote this in the 1850s when he was out of office and felt himself to be something of a failure. And he wrote that men were ruined by the one-sided practice of concealing blunders and failures. Basically, he was referring to what were common even then, self-help books and how to succeed books. And I thought, well, if Abraham Lincoln thinks that we need a book about failure, that's good enough for me. And so I got started on it.
I wonder what when, now, and as I understand, this began as your dissertation.
It did at Rutgers University.
And when, in the beginning, when people would ask you what it is you're going to write about, and you would say something like, well, you know, I was thinking about exploring failure in America. How did they greet that choice of topic?
Well, not only in the beginning, but all through the time I worked on the book, the general reaction was a nervous laugh, would be the way I would describe it. I think people are instantly interested in the topic of failure, but also instantly discomforted by it.
And I think that it's one of the things that's interesting, and you mentioned it, I've seen it in some of the articles that I've read about you in the book, is that While at the same time, it's something that we're very discomforted by, this idea of failure. In many families, buried, there are stories like those that you document in the book. And that, in fact, as you talked with people about the project that you were doing, there were people who told you stories of failure that came from their own families.
Yes. Very frequently when I would meet people and they would say, what are you working on or what do you do? And I would say I was writing a book about failure. There might be a joke, you know, you should put me in your book. But often they would say things like, you should put my father in your book. And I remember one woman in particular, she was a fellow historian, and I met her in the lunchroom at the John D. Rockefeller Archive Center in Tarrytown, New York. I was there to use the incoming correspondence to John D. Rockefeller. He received thousands of what then were called begging letters, which were letters from strangers who told long, sad stories of failure and defeat and asked for help in one way or another. And she was there to research something else that had to do with John D. Rockefeller's career. And she said, you should put my father in your book. And I said, what did your father do? And she said, he committed suicide. And that's kind of a conversation stopper. And so I decided just to listen quietly. And I said, you know, I'm very sorry. And she said, oh, it was years ago. You know, don't worry about it. But then she told me the story that her father had gone to Dartmouth College. And he had had a good but not distinguished career. And when the 25th reunion of his college class came around, he received in the mail a questionnaire designed to elicit information that could be assembled into some sort of class book. And the questionnaire included questions like, where is your summer home? And he reacted so badly to the stock-taking that he was required to do of his life in order to fill out this questionnaire that he shot himself. And she wrote a letter to Dartmouth, she told me, that she was so angry with them for the insensitivity of the questions, which seemed to assume that anyone who goes to Dartmouth, of course, has a distinguished and brilliant career ahead of them. And although her father was a good and hardworking man, that had not turned out to be the case for him. I think that is, there is a variation on that story in every family. And many, many people that I've met have shared those stories with me.
Just as a way of introducing the basic idea and this idea of how people thought about failure and how it changed over this roughly 100-year period. Let me ask you first, talk a little bit about failure in the early 1800s and when people used that word, how they used it and what it meant.
Okay. One of the things that surprised me a great deal when I got back into letters and diaries and newspapers of the early 1800s was that the word failure applied only to men who went bankrupt in business, which means it applied only to white entrepreneurs. There were other white men who were not entrepreneurs, laborers, artisans, etc. And, of course, there were women and African Americans and others in the United States. None of those people were, in a sense, eligible to be failures. Failure referred very specifically to going bankrupt in business. And the way that I explain this in my book is that when you or I use the word today, I feel like a failure or you're such a failure, we're using the language of business to evaluate the soul, because when we use it today, we're really talking about the whole person and not just a business venture. So that's how it started in the early 1800s. The word loser, likewise, was a neutral term, a sort of morally neutral term. I'll give you an example. There was a great fire in Boston in 1820, and one of the newspapers reporting that disaster that had burned down a particular hotel, the article said, the owner of the hotel is a great loser, chiefly in furnitures and liquors. So a loser in early America was somebody who lost property, usually through fire, natural disaster. It might be theft. And it also might be through bungling business practices. But a loser described the event rather than describing the inside of the person to whom the event happened.
Mm-hmm. And that is there, you pointed what the big change is over that period of time, going from the point where failure generally meant having failed in business. And as you point out in the book, people actually used language like he made a failure to talk about their lack of success. But then by the end of the 1800s, people were talking very differently, and it started to be about not about a venture, not about an experience, but about the person. That is, it's not just the business failed, it's the person failed. So then the question is, why? Why that change?
You're right. Going back to that locution, he made a failure. It's equivalent to, I made a mistake. He made a mistake. So a failure was still something, even in early America, that you were responsible for. It was your fault, and you had to, you know, live up to your promises, etc. But it didn't define the inside of your person, and that comes in the middle and late part of the 19th century. And there are really two developments. One is that the American economy changes dramatically through the 19th century. People, of course, know about the Industrial Revolution. And one of the ways that it changed is that more people became employees across the course of the 19th century, which means more people, fewer people were entrepreneurs. And so the older idea of failure, that a failure is somebody who goes bankrupt in business, gives way to evaluating people in a different walk of life, people who are employees and screw up and get fired, etc. The other way that it changed is that the 19th century invented most of the ways we think of today of keeping track of the trajectory or the course or the achievements of your life. So, you know, all of your listeners will shudder in some way if I say, this is going into your permanent record. We all heard that somewhere along the line. But before the mid-1800s, you didn't have a permanent record. There weren't filing systems and bureaucracies to keep track of every part of your life. And what that meant was that before the Civil War, it was easier to walk away from your failures and start over without a record, a public record of what had happened following you wherever you went.
I think it's really interesting, as you point out here, that in early America, the kind of failure that people feared most was moral failure. And at that time, perhaps failing in business was not such a big deal. But that by the end of this period that we're talking about here, somehow failing in business had become moral failure or a sign of moral failure.
Yes. Another early meaning of the word failure in American culture is a religious meaning. It comes from the 12th Psalm, which speaks of people ceasing and failing from the Lord, which is King James's way of saying wandering off God's path. So in early America, sometimes if you talked about failure, you were talking about moral transgressions or wandering away from a moral path. By the end of the century, the country has secularized, and those kinds of issues are secondary to financial failure, and that's, I think, more familiar to us today, that even if you're not a business person, we've been talking in the last month in Washington and around the country about bankruptcy, for example. Mm-hmm. And the conversation I'm hearing going on right now is that we need to tighten our bankruptcy laws because people are too lax. People run up big bills with no intention of ever paying them or no realistic expectation of ever being able to pay them, and then they walk away, and that we need to tighten our sense of personal moral responsibility. Those exact arguments for and against bankruptcy law were used in the 1800s. So this is an old conversation and one that we have never, I think, as Americans quite come to terms with. We know what we think about success in America, but I'm not sure that anyone could say we know what we think about failure.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Scott Sandage. He's Associate Professor of History at Carnegie Mellon University. And if you're interested in reading his book on the subject, it's titled Born Losers, A History of Failure in America. It's published by the Harvard University Press. And also, people are welcome into the conversation with questions or comments. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things I think it's probably important to talk about is a way of background, is the fact that this time that we're talking about, this time period, was a time of great economic upheaval in the United States. And I'm sure everybody knows about the Great Depression and the crash of 29. But in the century before that, there were a series of economic crises and panics in 1819, 1837, 1873, 1857, 1893, and then, of course, there also was the Civil War. So this was a very difficult economic time, and there were a lot of people who experienced economic devastation in their lives.
Absolutely right. I think people think of the 19th century as a fairly prosperous time because it is, of course, the century when American capitalism matured. We talk about the Gilded Age. But it was an extremely volatile time economically and culturally as a result of that. And you mentioned the Panic of 1819, and a panic was the word that they used before we switched to talking about crashes and slumps and downturns. And the Panic of 1819 was a really bewildering event because it was the first national economic crisis. There had been, of course, panics and crashes in New York City, but this was the first national crisis. So if you are a farmer, let's say, in Ohio, and suddenly you find that hard times have come on because some bank in New York City went bust, that's a difficult thing to understand in 1819. People didn't have a sense that we were all interconnected in one economy, and if it went bad, this would affect everyone, not just speculators and stock brokers and people like that. And so when a farmer found that he couldn't get money, and I mean that literally, when hard times came in the 19th century, you couldn't get your hands on money. You couldn't get paper money or coin, and paper money was not centrally printed, so there was Ohio paper money and New York paper money and Maryland paper money. So when the money system went down, that affected everybody. But it had never been that way before, and it was quite bewildering to people.
Well, you, in the process of doing the book, collected stories and looked at what this meant in the lives of people. Can you talk about when this happened, what happened to people, what they did?
Sure. That was my main purpose in writing the book, was I wanted to look at the experience of failure in America through the eyes of people who actually failed. And that meant I wanted to find ordinary, forgotten Americans and try as much as possible to recover their feelings and their statements about the ordeals that they went through, rather than writing a book on failure, say, through the eyes of famous people who failed first but succeeded later. People like Ulysses S. Grant or Thomas Edison, everyone knows they had trouble early on and then became these great men. I wanted to write a book about people who experienced failure and stayed down and weren't able, even if they tried, to get back up. That was a tough research agenda in the sense that if you're a loser, when you die, the Library of Congress doesn't ask your wife to give them your papers. And so I was assuming that it was going to be difficult to find personal reminiscences of ordinary people who failed. That turned out to be an inaccurate assumption because I think failure was so common in 19th century America that bits and pieces of ordinary experience did get saved, and in part because every family has a black sheep or every family has a loser. And so if you're a loser and your cousin is a congressman, letters about you or from you might get preserved in his or her papers. But the central caches of evidence that I found were things like credit reports, the earliest done in Bradstreet credit reports, those begging letters that I mentioned before. And in those kinds of sources, I was able to see how people reacted to failure and how they thought about themselves or thought about others whom they knew who failed. And some of the reactions are not surprising. There is, of course, a lot of shame and stigma and disgrace. But one of the interesting things was that I found people indicating that they were aware that there was a national myth of success, an idea that anyone in America who works hard will succeed. They were aware that this was almost a creed for Americans. And so when they failed, they felt cheated in a way by these assumptions that they had been led to believe were true, and also they tended to defend themselves, even proactively, against assumptions by others that they must be lazy, alcoholic, incompetent, etc. And so that, in a sense, is the core of the book, the idea that failure is a problem because in America, good people don't succeed. If only bad people failed, if only lazy people or incompetent people or crooked people failed, it wouldn't be a problem. The problem of failure is that good people fail. And that's, I think, an issue that we've been trying to come to terms with for 200 years and are still struggling with in modern conversations, not only about bankruptcy, but about Social Security, etc.
We have a caller, and I would certainly welcome anybody else who's listening if you have questions for our guest. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. First caller in line here is listening over in Bloomington Normal on our line 4. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if you could compare the bankruptcy laws in the United States with bankruptcy laws in Europe. I've always assumed that the bankruptcy laws here in this country were more lenient because there was a tradition of almost the frontier, the ability to start over, to a new beginning and so on. And this was the land where you could start over. And so bankruptcy laws were written with that in mind, the idea of being able to do it again. Can you comment on that?
Yes, indeed. one thing that's interesting when you compare American bankruptcy law to European bankruptcy law is that Americans have not had bankruptcy laws for a very long time. The bankruptcy law of England, for example, dates to the time of Henry VIII, and other European countries have had them for a much longer period of time. Now, you might say, well, that's because we're a young country. Yes and no. Basically, the United States did not have a federal bankruptcy system until after the Civil War, which is a long time to wait, given that we were discussing a few minutes ago the various economic setbacks and crashes that happened during that period. And when I tried to figure out why was it that Congress, although specifically authorized by the Constitution to pass bankruptcy laws, didn't do so before the Civil War. They passed two very brief laws, one in 1800 and one in 1841, both of those quickly repealed, so that before the Civil War, the United States had a bankruptcy law for a total of less than 4 years. The answer, surprisingly, is that slavery played a big part in American bankruptcy law coming into being. And the issue was this. A bankruptcy law is a law that the government passes and says, we, the government, in our wise opinion, have decided that for the good of everyone in society, we're going to take property away from the person who legitimately or legally owns that property and nullify that relationship. And so there was a parallelism between nullifying debts and freeing slaves. That was part of the reluctance of America to pass bankruptcy laws. The other part is the more commonly known part, which is that we have this deep public creed of personal responsibility. And so when hard times came on and Congress began discussing whether to pass bankruptcy legislation, there were always a chorus of voices that said that, you know, this would mean the end of personal responsibility as we know it. And so while today we talk about should we tighten the bankruptcy law in this way or that way, for the first almost 100 years of American history, they talked about should we have a bankruptcy law at all, and usually the answer was no.
I see. Okay. I think failure in America, if I could just make one more comment, failure in America is particularly difficult because when you fail in America, there's no excuse. We have this tradition of opportunity that sociologists have talked about. Probably the classic book there is Eli Chenoy's book, Auto Workers and the American Dream.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a tradition of opportunity that says that anybody with skill and who works hard and who's ambitious can succeed, then what does it say about the people who fail? And that usually redounds to individual character, that there must be something wrong with me. And that leads to all kinds of self-hatred and self-doubt, because you can't blame, you know, if we lived in India where there's a caste system, you can always say, well, I couldn't achieve because I belong to this untouchable caste and that was my fate. But in America where you have a completely open class system and everybody's telling you that the sky's the limit, if you don't make it, what does that say about your character, your ability, your personal worth? And so it's kind of the opposite, the darker side of an open class system is something that is very tough for individuals who don't make it. And most people don't make it to the top. So it's kind of tough.
Yeah, I think you've put your finger exactly on it. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Just for a moment here, I have a couple of other callers I want to get to. But I'm interested because you were talking a little bit about bankruptcy law and the fact that it hasn't been around all that long. Certainly this time period we're talking about, it's a long way until the New Deal. Did people in government, in the federal government in Washington, think that there was something the government could do or should do to help people who had failed?
What time period are you talking?
Well, the I guess the period that we're talking about here in the book, that is roughly,
okay,
you know, between 1800 and 1900.
Yeah, in a sense, the New Deal is the fruit of 100 years of arguing about whether a government safety net or government intervention was appropriate in certain circumstances. And so all the way back to 1819 and for, you know, 80 years after that, when relief bills of various kind, debt reforms, bankruptcy laws, and all of these are complicatedly different categories of law. But when those kinds of relief bills would come up, the argument always devolved into, you know, the question of whether the government should step in or whether personal moral responsibility was an absolutely sacrosanct part of the American experience and should never be tampered with under any conditions. The crash of 1929, leading into the Great Depression, is obviously the biggest crash, the biggest economic setback to that time, and so it provided stronger impetus than some previous crashes had. But those same arguments about intervention versus personal moral responsibility were heard in the 1930s as well.
We have a couple of callers here. We will continue and talk next with someone in Urbana, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Yeah, you were talking to start with about Lincoln, and which is pretty timely since they're opening up his museum and library. And yesterday I just saw a billboard that praised his persistence, because I understand he failed in his political career quite a few times before succeeding. So I thought that was interesting. And then, about the last caller, I think a lot of people would argue with the idea of a culture of opportunity, and not the least of which would be minorities. But I got a question about something else, really. And it kind of has to do with the fact that in these surveys that are done, Americans are never amongst the happiest in the world. I mean, the American people. And And yet the Declaration of Independence speaks of the right of the pursuit of happiness as an inalienable right, and you would think it'd be one of our marks of success. And so I was wondering, have you thought about or noticed any kind of relationship between the connotations of failure and the idea of happiness? Is there some sort of relationship there or not?
Let me address quickly the two comments that you made about Abraham Lincoln and about minorities and the idea of equal opportunity, and then I'll come back to this issue of happiness. Abraham Lincoln, I've seen the same billboard I think that you have seen, and it says something failed,
right.
And then something about the value of persistence. There is something of a failure myth about Abraham Lincoln in that when you see the list of the times that Lincoln failed, some of those events are not precisely accurate. But it is true that Lincoln went bankrupt in business as a young man, and it's also true that he felt politically frustrated because he tried many times to reach national office before he was able to do so. And as many people also know, he struggled with depression and melancholia his whole life. So Lincoln thought a lot and wrote a lot about failure. But he also wrote a lot about opportunity. And that leads to your second point. What we call opportunity, Lincoln called the race of life. That was a phrase that he used over and over in his speeches. And in some of the speeches that he made just before he was elected president while campaigning, he said that, you know, the idea of America was that each of us would run the race of life and have a chance to get ahead, and that he thought that that chance should apply equally to black men or white men. But as you know, after the Civil War, the experiences of former slaves was not quite what one might have hoped for. And so this issue of the opportunity, and we call it a myth, not so much as a story that's not true, but as a sort of a nationally believed religion, the idea of opportunity in America and the idea that some, and the fact that some people have much less opportunity than others is a very real problem. And it's in my book, the way I try to deal with it is I talk about the democratization of failure. At the beginning of the hour, we noted that in the early 1800s, only white men in business could be failures. But by the early 1900s, anybody could be a failure. And that's an irony of ironies, that even if the opportunity for success did not expand as quickly as we might like to think it did, or as far as we might even today think that it, or say that it did, failure did expand, and that compounds, I think, the problems that we've been talking about. Happiness, the third issue that you brought up, is absolutely something that runs through discussions of loserdom and failure in American life, because as early as Henry David Thoreau at Walden, people are beginning to talk about, would you rather be successful financially or happy personally? And Thoreau's experiment to go off to Walden Pond is meant as a demonstration that you really can live much more simply. You don't need as much money as you think you do. You don't have to work as steadily or as often as it may seem that you do, and that it is in fact possible to choose a different path of life than the ladder of professional and financial success. On the other hand, I'm a college professor, and when I teach Thoreau to young people, the first impression that I have to overcome with them is Thoreau's that crazy Unabomber guy who went out to the pond. So there's a sense that people who choose happiness over professional and financial advancement are eccentric and sort of few and far between, and perhaps sometimes they say inspiring things, but it's certainly not something you would want your child to pick for him or herself.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you, in fact, begin the book with a little story about the funeral of Thoreau, at which Ralph Waldo Emerson spoke, and he lamented Thoreau's lack of ambition, that is, in the words of Emerson, that Thoreau had done so little with his life. He said, "He seemed born for greatness, and I cannot help counting it a fault in him that he had no ambition."
Emerson, of course, was Thoreau's teacher at Harvard, and Thoreau was the star student and protege. So Emerson had very high hopes for Thoreau. And in that eulogy in 1862, he said that he looked at this young man and thought he could be a general, a president, an engineer, and he chose, in Emerson's words, to be the captain of a huckleberry party, which meant that he would prefer to pick berries rather than build skyscrapers or lead armies. And Emerson was disappointed, and Thoreau lived long enough for the two men to have a rift and then to repair it shortly before Thoreau died. But Thoreau died of tuberculosis at the age of 44. So it was a sense, I think, for Emerson, of a life cut short, but also a life wasted in a certain way.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Scott Sandage. He's a cultural historian who specializes in 19th century America. He's an associate professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University. And if you'd like to read more on this subject that we're talking about here this morning, you should look for his book, which is titled Born Losers, A History of Failure in America. It's published by the Harvard University Press. We have some other callers. Let's go on to Urbana next line, too. Hello.
Hi. I would disagree that we don't have castes in this country. I would say that if you're born a poor African-American, that there's a lot of societal expectations among your friends that it's you're being an Oreo if you show signs of success, and that it is hard to overcome those expectations. We lived in a country that has castes, and I was asked by a driver of a particular caste, car driver, because in Kathmandu, it's kind of, there's no place to park, and it's very, very hard to drive. An embassy person's driver asked me what caste I was as he dropped me off, and thought about it for a minute, and I was thinking, now, what is it, how do you describe castes in Nepal? And one of the ways that you do is by, you can tell by people's names what caste they are. I can sometimes tell by somebody's name what ethnic group they come from, and it gives me some expectations, like it or not, about that person. And you know, we do, our castes are more mobile than in a country with where it's tied in with religion, but I think we still have some. The other thing I wanted to say was I wanted to ask whether there was predatory lending in the past, the way there seems to be now. Now you hear about how if somebody is late on their utility bill payment, that their credit card interest rate might go up. I had a friend who had no health insurance and developed diabetes and was having difficulty with her Sears bill. So some of us got together and paid down some of it for her. And when I took the money over to Sears, they said, "Oh, we'll tell her she doesn't have to make her next couple of payments, minimum payments." Because I wanted to make sure it got that it was not that they were, we were paying down the principal on this thing. And I thought to myself, this company is out to just milk as much interest from this poor person as they possibly can. It's one thing when, a tradesperson doesn't get paid. It's another thing when a company like Sears keeps piling on interest charges and tries to keep you in the dark and about how much you're paying in interest and tries to encourage you to keep your bill going. That's different. And I'm wondering whether the same sorts of things were going on in the past. And I also think, I just think it's terrible that we, this bankruptcy bill is not taking into consideration, not putting any requirements on companies to be fair lenders.
Those are some terrific questions and also some really moving stories to go with them. The two issues that the caller brought up, one is caste and the other predatory lending, have something of a caste system in the United States, and one of the things that came out repeatedly in my research was the way in which our conversations about success and failure mask that idea, hide or obscure the caste or class systems in the United States. The idea of success is that anyone who succeeds has done it on their own, and we talk about self-made men and self-made people. And as David was pointing out earlier, if you fail, it's your fault. And around 100 years ago, W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American intellectual, named this the great American assumption, the assumption that wealth is mainly the result of its owner's effort and that any average worker can, by thrift, become a capitalist. That's a quote from Du Bois. And those assumptions remain very strong, even though if you look at the statistics of who we are in America, you know, entrepreneurship continues to be seen as the ideal, but it has declined absolutely through census to census to census, from, you know, 26% around 1870 to 10% around 1970. So even as the facts that we see before our eyes tell us that that these myths are not true, we continue to believe very strongly in them and to use them against ourselves and each other. Predatory lending is an interesting practice. It, of course, goes back to usury and to you know, loan sharking of all varieties for thousands of years. But in the 19th century, there wasn't predatory lending in the sense that we think of it today, because there wasn't consumer credit in the way that we think of it today. The credit that a consumer would have had in the 19th century was with a grocery store or some kind of local business, and that was kept in a book under the counter, and you could sometimes pay it off with a goat or butter. So there was a much more fluid kind of economy, and it was a much more local economy. Nationalized credit begins not as something that is extended to consumers, but as something that is extended to business people. So if I am a storekeeper in Ohio and I want to stock the latest fashionable textiles, you know, in bolts of cloth, I need to get those from a wholesaler or a jobber in New York City. And in order to get those, I need credit, because I can't pay for expensive cloth unless I sell it. So I have to get it first and then sell it and send the money back. The problem of learning whether you could trust somebody who lived hundreds of miles away from you is the way Dun & Bradstreet was born. In 1841, an entrepreneur named Lewis Tappan invented this system for checking up on people all over the country. And it's a really fascinating system in that it was a surveillance system, a system that used covert operatives in small towns all across America to give seasonal reports on the people in that town. So in the 19th century, as opposed to our own today, it was more an atmosphere of let the lender beware rather than let the borrower beware, because if you lent money or extended credit to someone who was not trustworthy, you would be the person holding the bag, not them. It was simply not yet possible to trace people the way we can trace them today. So it was easier to run out on your debts than it is today.
I'm going to have to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're getting short on time, and I'm glad that you at least touched on Lewis Tappan, because I think that's one of the really fascinating stories in the book. You were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that we have grown up in the era of the permanent record, and that if you go back far enough, that there was no such thing, but that his creation of what amounted to a national credit reporting agency was maybe the beginning of the permanent record, and had far and wide implications. And of course, and interestingly enough, as you tell some of the stories, there also were many errors that were created, and someone could be ruined by false information given by a competitor or someone who just had a grudge against them.
Absolutely. Two of the issues that we struggle with today are how your involvement in the marketplace compromises your privacy. You know, if you use your discount card at the grocery store each time you buy groceries, then a profile begins to accumulate about you, about your buying habits and your spending habits, etc. And we also worry about computer errors today, that if an error is made on your credit report or your credit statement, you know, this can dog you for months or years and ruin your life. Both of those issues came up as early as the 1840s, and I was just astonished when I came across Louis Tappan. Louis Tappan was an abolitionist. He was more of a moral reformer than he was a business visionary, and he felt that someone needed to bring morality into business transactions, and that meant finding out if people were morally trustworthy. And so from that impetus, he began this credit reporting service. It was based in New York City, but he recruited very effectively covert operatives in towns and cities all across America. So he starts in 1841, and by 1850, he has 2,000 operatives around the United States. Now, according to the 1850 census, in the year 1850, there were only 938 photographers in the U.S. So this was an enormous undertaking, and the way that he organized his information was, in a way, a precursor to a computer. It was an information system, and these reports came in from all over the country. They were entered into a central data bank of big old ledgers. Those ledgers were cross-referenced and indexed, and by the time the system was up and running in the mid-1840s, they could basically find any person in America in about a week's time. Now, finding them and getting them to pay their bills were two different problems, and so his purpose was to prevent you from getting credit in the first place if you were not the sort of person who should be trusted. And at the beginning of this hour, I said one of the ways that I describe failure is the language of business applied to the soul. The language that was invented by credit reporters to this day is the language that we use to describe ourselves as losers. A second-rate or a third-rate person, those are credit reporting terms. If you're third-rate, it means that you are the kind of person who deserves to borrow money at the third-best rate of interest. Good for nothing. You know, I feel good for nothing. You're good for nothing. Again, that's a credit term. It means you are good to borrow zero money, rather than somebody who's good for $20, good for $100. So the very language that has seeped into our culture and into our minds, really, as we organize and assess ourselves and assess people around us, is language that goes back to these old-time businessmen before the Civil War.
And just to add, to make a connection to the name that came up earlier in the conversation, one of these people that provided information to the Mercantile Agency about people in this area was Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, there's a mystery there in that Dun & Bradstreet, which is, of course, a thriving company, has always been very proud of and has used in its publicity and its company histories, etc., the idea that Abraham Lincoln was one of those covert operatives, and indeed he was. He provided information from Springfield on his friends and neighbors that went into the big book back in New York City. But the thing is, Louis Tappan not only watched the people that his operatives reported on, he watched his operatives too. And so even as Abraham Lincoln was reporting on his neighbors, one of those neighbors was reporting on Abraham Lincoln. So there is a credit report that exists today that tells us some things about Abraham Lincoln. And, of course, it explodes some of the myths because he was a prosperous middle-class lawyer. He represented big railroads. He wasn't a sort of, you know, country bumpkin by any means. But sometime after Lincoln's death, somebody in the company expunged part of Abraham Lincoln's credit report, and by expunged, I mean they literally scraped the ink off these old linen pages, and they did such a good job of it that when I had this page examined, it's currently in the Harvard Business School Library, but when I had this page examined by modern techniques, neither infrared nor ultraviolet scanning could bring up any trace of ink being left behind on the page. What this means is that at some point before Lincoln became president, somebody reported something about him that was considered relevant enough to enter into the book and considered damaging enough to expunge it after he became a martyr. And so in the margin, right next to this point where they erased Lincoln's credit report, somebody has drawn a black cross and Lincoln states, and sort of rest in peace.
Well, I must apologize. We have a couple of callers that we just can't take because we've come to the end of the hour, and we're going to have to stop. It's quite a fascinating story, and often, as history does, and not only does it tell us something about that time, but it tells us something about our time. I think there's some lessons for us to be taken away, certainly, from looking at this period and this change in the notion of what failure means.
Thank you very much for having me, David.
Well, I appreciate you giving us your time. Scott Sandage, he is Associate Professor of History at Carnegie Mellon University. And again, if you'd like to read the book, and there is more in it than we have touched on in this hour, the title of the book is Born Losers, A History of Failure in America, and it is published by the Harvard University Press. You've been listening to a Focus 580 interview first broadcast earlier this year. It comes from the Focus Archives. If you'd like to hear some past programs you might have missed, or listen to interviews from the Afternoon Magazine or any other of our local production, you can go to that website anytime that you like. It's will.uiuc.edu. We hope that you will enjoy the rest of your day. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
This is the Afternoon Magazine coming up on WILL AM 580. I'm Tom Rogers, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. Celeste Quinn has gone throughout the week this week, and we've been running interviews from the archives, as you just heard from Focus 580. The 1 o'clock interview that we'll hear with Celeste back from April 6th was done with journalist Stephen Bogira. And he spent a year inside one of the busiest courtrooms in the nation, one of the busiest courthouses in the nation, the Cook County Courthouse at 26 in California. It's a fairly place with a reputation for lots of business and what is right and what's wrong with the legal system. His book that he wrote based on that experience is called Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse. And Steve Bogira was interviewed by Celeste Quinn back in April. We'll hear that interview again starting at 1:06 this afternoon on AM 580. Let's take a look now at how the markets are doing. And after a very busy and well-up start this morning, at the noon hour, the prices have turned downward a little bit. The beans are still up by quite a wide margin, but wheat and corn now down. The July contract for wheat is at 328.5, down 3.5.